everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
We're here with you at The Positive Mind. Usually Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays from 1 to 2 o'clock. Here with a special today, a longer program, bringing you some different things to consider. And today, we're going to talk to you about nature. Yes, more about nature, and specifically about the sexual nature of the human being, and how that affects just about everything we do. This is a series of programs that Roberta Atti and I have been doing, and in this series, we were talking about different things related to sex, and how sex affects, or how the evolution of sex has affected our culture, our society. Now, of course, you've heard a great deal about this, but I think you're going to find it particularly interesting today. Today we're going to be talking about sex and mating, actual mating itself, mating behaviors and how our mating is chosen by some biological mandates and imperatives that we've inherited. Only we humans have this, not like other animals. And also we're going to talk about parenting. Michael, if you could get the phones off, it'd be a good time right now, I think.
Unless the calls are for us, of course.
But then who's going to take the call now? Hey, let's go back a little bit. Let's just do a quick review. Roberta, 2 weeks ago, the first one of these programs, which we did, we talked about the big head, the small pelvis theory.
Yes, we talked about an impasse, as the French would call it, a bottleneck, as Dr. Schlein calls it. Dr. Schlein, by the way, Leonard Schlein is his name, is a surgeon, laparoscopic surgery, chief of laparoscopic surgery at San Francisco Medical Center.
It's nice to know that there's somebody who makes sure you have a nice lap. You know, that's what he does. He examines the lap and he says, you've got to have a good lap nowadays. And if not, I'm going to do surgery to give you a good lap.
Isn't he wonderful? So Dr. Schlein wrote this book called Sex, Time and Power, How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution. And this is the third book he has written. The second book is The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, which Armand and I have reviewed a couple of times on the air a few years ago. This book came out recently, and I find it fascinating. And we've been reviewing his book, and then Armand also brought into the research we've been doing a book by Robin Baker. He's a British scientist, and his book, the title of his book is Sperm Wars. So, based on what we've been studying and researching and working on, I go back now to the impasse, to the bottleneck. The bottleneck is that about 140,000 years ago, we find remains in Africa by Lake Victoria of lots of young women, young hominid women dying in childbirth. And the reason for the death is that the head of their fetuses was too big to make it through the pelvis structure. At that time, young mothers and their babies were dying in large numbers. And Dr. Schlein speculates that perhaps this threat of death in childbirth became the motivation, the spur that brought these women to a new awareness. And the new awareness is the connection between mating, being out on a romantic adventure, and 9 months later having a baby, possibly dying from that event. So that was what we reviewed in the first of the series.
Bottom line of it became that the women suddenly, you know, where mating behavior simply is, if an animal is in estrus, it sends out a signal, usually through pheromones and through olfactory systems. The male picks it up and he says, I smell a perspective, and everything in him wakes up. He gets stimulated, not stimulated otherwise. He sees a female who is in estrus, and he says, I guess I'll go mate with that thing. And he does that. He jumps on, he mates, he walks away. Both of them take it as a casual kind of thing that happened. She's ready for it. He's ready for it. Certain times. Estrus determines. Estrus being the time of the month when she's most likely to conceive.
But
that's most animals.
The thing is that most animals don't die in childbirth, or at least not nearly. They don't have nearly the high incidence of mortality caused by childbirth as humans do. So
this is humans when their heads started getting bigger because they needed bigger heads to be able to think in order to survive.
In humans, the prominent evolutionary gift, let's call it, has been intelligence. Because let's face it, we're not that strong, we're not that agile, we're not that fit compared to most higher species of mammals, and even birds, I mean, even other categories, not just mammals. So our advantage has been that we're so smart, we're so intelligent, we've invested a tremendous amount of evolutionary energy in being intelligent, more intelligent than other species. So the brain had to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and it got to a point where the head of this baby was so big that it would get stuck. And the female giving birth would die, and so would the baby. So females somehow arrived at the connection, making a connection between having sex, giving birth to a baby, a certain amount of time, 9 moons later, and dying. Now, this requires an abstraction, meaning that the mind has to be able to make a leap into the future and has to be able to imagine something that has not yet happened. And this leap is a quantum leap in evolution.
Right, because as of this point, there is no abstract thinking.
Right, as there still isn't in animals.
Right.
In animals like dogs and cats and monkeys and chimpanzees, the thinking happens, but it happens in the present. It is in this moment now, and everything related to that thought happens in the now and is present to the now. However, some of the higher species around are beginning. We're beginning to discover that they have some capacity for abstraction, but nowhere near the amount that humans have.
So humans, human females, figure it out. Hey, if I have sex when I'm too small, right, when my pelvis isn't developed full enough, because at age 10 I could have sex, or 11 I could have sex, some male comes along and decides to have sex with me as soon as I'm an estrus, I may not be able to carry it. So that's one problem. Second problem is, if I get pregnant, there may not be a male around to protect me. So the female, first thinking, probably the first hominid thinking of all times, besides where do I get a sandwich, is how do I stop this guy from jumping on my bones?
Mm. Right.
Now, so this is the very first thinking of mankind, and humankind.
According to Dr. Schlein's theory. And
according to Robin
research.
Baker and a couple of other people as well.
Okay.
So the very first idea here is, how do I keep this happening? Well, what I'll do is, I'll stop myself from sending out signals that I'm ready.
Mm.
I won't let the man know that I'm an estrus, so I'm going to cover myself up, I'm going to hide my signals, I'm going to change my smell. And you get the modern woman, who is now capable of hiding her sexual preparedness, readiness.
But also that puts me in control of when I mate.
You as a woman.
Right, because in a female, in an animal situation, whenever the female is ready, she basically has no choice. Once the pheromones are out there, they're out there. And she doesn't have much of a choice unless she's able to outrun the male or to hide, or which is almost impossible. But in a female, the estrus is hidden. The male does not know that she's fertile. So she can be more in control of when she mates.
Now, if mating is the primary goal of all living beings, because it has to keep the species going, right? Is this what you usually say, Roberta? Species first.
Sure, that's absolutely true for every species. No, what I mean is the group first before the individual. The individual is meaningless. What's important is the whole group.
So if species is the purpose, if keeping the species going is the main reason we're here, and the female says, well, I'm going to be the one to determine how we keep the species going and when and where the mating takes place, let us no longer question man's power on this earth. I mean, really.
In Dr. Schlein's theory, that's precisely why that's the beginning of misogyny. That's the beginning of men's anger towards females, because females have the power to say no. And the wound, the psychological wound caused by a rejection of a female, is supposedly, I don't know because I'm not a male, but supposedly one of the hardest things for a male to get over. It's very, very wounding. And so one of the ways, one of the strategies is, okay, let's control the female 100%. Let's be completely in control of her as if she were an object, so that she might have the power to reject us, but we have every other form of power over her life that we can imagine.
So if I don't want her to reject me, I will keep her where I want her to be, keep her totally dependent on me, keep her crippled, keep her down, make sure she has no other power.
Right.
And if we could do that,
Then her power is meaningless.
Her power is relatively small.
And I think one of the things that Dr. Schlein says that really touched my heart, and I really would like to say this to all the mothers out there, if I may. He says one of the most important antidotes to offset misogyny in a boy, in a young man, and misogyny is very tempting because it's all over the place. You know, there's a great deal of misogyny in the culture that we live in. One of the ways is mother's love, meaning that if the boy, and by the way, let me just define misogyny. Misogyny means hatred of women. Hatred of women can be very overt, or it can also be subtle, and it can express itself in a way that it's not visible. It's hard to pinpoint how exactly this is manifesting, and yet it's pervasive, socially pervasive, and it's so strong that it keeps women down, even though outwardly we're all saying that women are liberated. But when we look at the reality of a woman's life, we find that many aspects of it are not liberated at all. I'm not going to get into that because that's not the topic. But one of the things that Leonard Schlein says is, well, to help boys grow up not hating women, one of the best things we can do is, as a mother, love them unconditionally. Because if a boy has in his pocket his absolute unconditional mother's love, so that he knows that for her he comes first, and that no matter what he does, she will never reject him, she will never judge him, she will never blame him, she will always love him unconditionally, that goes a long way to offset the damage caused by the rejection of a subsequent woman or a mate.
Well, I said just then. Armand DeMille here with Roberta Atti. We're talking to you about human sexuality and how human sexuality shaped society. We're talking specifically today about mating and parenting, and that the role that that this all took, as women suddenly had the power, the female had the power to say to the male, no, not now. And so she changes her body, she changes her scent, she doesn't let us know his readiness. Now, this leaves the male in a strange condition, because whereas in the past, he would use hunger to know when he wanted to eat, you know, so a lion will not go out hunting if he's not hungry. They don't want to necessarily just hunt to kill. They're not killers, they're just eaters, they're food people, right? So now, he wants to know, you know, every now and then a female would come by and she'd be whiffy.
That's well put.
You like that word, whiffy?
Whiffy.
He comes a whiffy female, a whiffy woman. Mm-hmm. Or male would be whiffy, because mm-hmm. it means he's ready. No, but she would be whiffy, and she's whiffy, and he kind of...
Well, she's whiffy in a certain way, and then he becomes
whiffy
in
his way.
Yes.
Then suddenly he wakes up and he says, oh, I know that smell. This means love.
Right.
So he goes over and he mounts and he has sex, and that's the end of that, right? And then he goes back to sleep. until he gets hungry, and he could either eat or have sex, whichever one, or sleep, whatever he's in the mood for. Nothing special. But now take away the whiff. Now, he's got no whiff.
Or he has it all the time.
Or he has a whiff everywhere.
Right.
And he's confused.
Yeah.
And he says, I don't know which way to go. When am I going to be ready? When am I not going to be ready? And the man, therefore, has to be ready to respond anytime to anyone. That's the adjustment of the male being.
That's what happened as a result of this situation, where the female hid her estrus. So the male had to be ready all the time, because there was no longer a set time, as you just pointed out.
So he couldn't even go to sleep. I mean, he's got to be ready when he sleeps.
Yes.
If the moment happens while he's sleeping and suddenly she wakes him up and says, honey, now,
yeah.
Boom, he's got to be responsive.
Yeah. Yeah.
So male is always responsive all the time, supposed to be, ideally. Plus, we add to that that the demands on the male was more testosterone. That we're going to drive, we got to make him stronger, we got to make him chase animals, we got to make him be a better hunter, because he's got to bring back food for us in order to take care of us.
Us the women and the babies.
And the babies. So now a male he's ready for sex all the time with more testosterone.
Right.
So he's a potent being.
Right.
And this is the condition of human males, and human females. She's saying, I'm going to hold it back. I'm not going to let you know when I want it. And he's saying, I'm going to be ready whenever you say.
And this is conducive to higher and higher levels of testosterone, because for both mating and hunting, that's the hormone that would maintain that condition of readiness, both in bed as well as on the hunt.
Now, don't you think this stuff is fascinating? I mean, if you think about it, if the basic thing about men is they are always ready all the time. Does that mean always ready all the time, Roberta, means that men are basically, on a primitive level, sexual addicts?
No, I don't see it that way. Although I think it's possible that in our culture, someone would answer yes to the question you just asked. I think we confuse behavior that has developed as a response to evolutionary needs. We confuse that with compulsive behavior dictated by an unmet need. And I think we need to spend a minute defining what the two are and what the differences are. In males of the human species, more so than in any other species that we know of, there has come about a type of sexuality that is very compelling because, as we just said, the human male has to be always ready in order to be there when the time is right, when she says it's right, because sexuality is basically under the female's control. So she says now, and that's when he has a chance. And if he misses that chance, that's it. He may miss his chance of having an offspring, okay? So we have a brain that's wired that way. Then we have a society in which we see these males who tend to behave in ways that are compulsive around sex, meaning that they have to have an endless list of broken hearts behind them or about them, and that they cannot stop themselves from having one sexual exploit after another, and that they justify it in every possible way they can by saying that this is the way men are and I can't help myself and what's wrong with it, etc. And what we have now is a compulsive behavior where sex has become almost like a drug, meaning a way in which the man tries to get his needs met through sex, through that physical closeness, and through that establishment of power also, because sex has to do with power, with feeling the powerful self.
Well, you went back to the misogyny before, Roberta, as well.
Exactly.
It's the aggressive act. It's reducing the woman who has the power.
Right.
To her knees.
Yes. So that's sexual addiction. The fact that human males are so interested in sex does not make them sex addicts. Just makes them creatures that have developed in response to an evolutionary need that has created a nervous system and a brain that works that way for the specific needs of that species. But a sex addict, which could also be a female, of course, is someone who tries to get a certain need met through compulsive sex. And there's a big difference between the two. So to say that if a male is interested in sex all the time, he's a sex addict, I think it's jumping to a conclusion that may be unfair, looking at how his sexuality has evolved through the millions of years of human evolution.
So what we have to look at, therefore, is that there is sex becomes two ways now. It becomes a way of acting out aggression. It also becomes a way of following a biological imperative, right, which is to mate as often as possible with as many females as possible. But it doesn't work. The culture looks at this and says, this is no good. What are we going to do? What the culture did was what happened is, how are we going to keep men from having sex with women who are weaker than they are if the women are going to want to be, have children and be, you know, with one male? And So how do you develop this? How do you keep control over the male testosterone and the male drive to have sex with anything, anytime? And the way you do it is you develop law.
Yes. You develop law. Let's remember that the people who want to control male sexuality the most are men. We are under the misguided impression that it's women who want to control male sexuality, but in reality it's other men. Why? Because other men want to control their neighbor's sexuality to make sure that their offspring are theirs and not their neighbors.
we're going to have to go into this whole idea of man.
But it's male that develop laws and system to regulate behavior in order to control their own sexuality, because without laws that are enforced by the group and by all the males of the group, their own individual sexuality is so powerful that they're not sure they could control it themselves in the ways that they think it should be controlled. Isn't that a convoluted
thing? It's fascinating,
thing?
And it's an amazing thing that if you were to look at practically all law, in one form or another, certainly marital law, possession
all
law,
law,
all law
all
is
law.
About make sure he doesn't screw the wrong person. You know what I mean? Including thou
in
shalt
the end,
not
it
kill.
Comes
it's really,
down to
it
that.
Really comes down to.
Yep.
Leave my wife alone. Okay, well, this is Armand Demille with Roberta Atti. Mm-hmm. This is going to get fascinating, we promise you, as this kind of continues along. We want to talk about how this thing happened, about how the female and the male decided that marriage or coupling was a good idea. We all seem to yearn for some kind of special love in our life.
But that goes against our evolution.
It goes against it. But we're going to find that culture and evolution worked very well together.
Yes.
To produce some different way of doing it.
A very successful species.
A very successful
because,
species.
Because, I mean, let's face it, we're so successful that we're overdoing it a bit.
And so so we're going to be talking about
yes.
that. This is Armand Demille with Roberta Atti. We are here with you today for an extended period of time. And when we come back, we're going to be talking more about the selection process, which will help you a great deal, my friends, with your mating behaviors, I promise. And you'll get to understand why wives want their husbands to remember anniversaries, I think. We'll be back with you in just a little bit. This is Armand Demille with Roberta Atti. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial here at WBAI. We are talking about mating behaviors. And we're back with you now. Now let's talk about this, Roberta. So then these laws are formed. And what are the laws formed? You got to figure out some way. Because, I guess you talked about parenting, right? You said, so somehow the male notices.
No, what I said was that the mating behavior, the sexual behavior of males of the human species need to be contained, but those who are doing the containing the most are other males. We are under the assumption that it's the females who want to, you know, put a lid on male sexuality because it gets in the way or something, and that may be the case, but nothing compared to how other males want to control their brothers' sexual and mating behavior in order to prevent confusion as far as paternity goes. So the laws and the structures, the social structures designed to control human behavior, ultimately all revolve around who owns whose children.
Now, this very interesting concept, we want you to keep in mind that this is 140,000 years ago. First, the woman says no. Right? Then they figured this thing out. When did the first cave drawings appear?
Okay, well, what ends up happening about 40,000 years ago, let's say there's about 100,000 years of evolution of hominids, Homo sapiens evolves. Through that time, when females took control of mating behavior by saying no, there's about 100,000 years after that where things continue to move along, and the woman has more and more established power and control over when she mates with whom, and things kind of go along, you know, smoothly and easily. Then all of a sudden you have an explosion of artistic expression in humans, as shown in these artworks found in caves and other places, other human dwellings, where you have an explosion of these paintings that draw scenes of hunt and scenes of death and scenes of birth and scenes of mating and lovemaking, and all kinds of human life becomes inspiration for these early artists. And this happens about 40,000 years ago. And it doesn't happen, it happens almost overnight, Armand, which is why it's puzzling. There doesn't seem to be a slow onset, but there seems to be, and there doesn't seem to be any significant change in the structure of human society to justify an explosion of artistic expression.
Well, it's a little like the 100th monkey.
Yes.
Syndrome.
Yes. Which is that all of a sudden when one monkey finds out one thing, all of a sudden all the other monkeys know that thing as well.
It was about a monkey washing a potato.
Even if they have not met or seen this new behavior, but they know it because there's a way of communication that goes beyond regular means, regular ways that we cannot explain rationally, but that happens in the mind of organisms. And so here we have an example of such an event whereby all of a sudden humans started expressing the issues that they were preoccupied with regarding life and death in all of their aspects. And they were so preoccupied and they were so enthralled with the whole idea of life and death that they started painting things in their home, in the caves that they were living in. This happens about 40,000 years ago. And the question is, why? Why 40,000 years ago?
Why all of a sudden are we suddenly have this other form? Because what this other form is another form of abstract thinking. Think about this. First, abstract thinking, how am I going to keep the man from jumping on my bones? Second, abstract thinking, well, how am I going to get enough things to make her want me to jump on her bones? Right? Third, abstract thinking, I'm going to make drawings. Mm. I mean, I'm sure some took place in between then.
Sure, but there was an explosion.
It kind of meant that somewhere on these cave drawings there appeared a concept of death.
Yes, that was not there before.
Now, we think about most animals, you know, they say, oh, animals accept death as a transition. You know, animals don't know what death is.
No. They're not preoccupied with it. They may know what it is when they see it, but they are not preoccupied
you
with it.
You sniff a dead animal, you sniff your fellow wolf, who you've been mated to monogamously, and you, oh, no more of that life stuff coming out.
But they may even have feelings, like with the book, the person who wrote that book, When Elephants Weep,
mm-hmm.
right? Animals may very well have feelings of sadness and grief, may experience death as a life-changing event, death of a companion, for instance, but they're not preoccupied with it. And the interesting thing, the reason why we bring this into our discussion today is because sex and death, as Freud would have said, would have agreed with us on, go together, meaning that sexual behavior and the awareness of death and the awareness of parenting, especially on the part of males, comes with the awareness of death.
All right.
There's a big link there that we need to talk about.
We're going to have to talk about your big link.
What?
Here it is, WBAI. Sex and death go together.
Mm.
It's like a date. You know, you have a party. Everybody come dressed as your favorite thing. I'll come dressed as sex. I'll come dressed as death. Those two most likely to come. The French call this le petit mort,
uh-huh.
the orgasm, right?
Yep, yep.
Sex and death, the little death. How do sex and death go together? That's one of the questions we have here at WBAI 99.5 FM. And if you've just tuned in, you want to learn more about this. This is Roberta Atti and Armand DeMille. Here we go. Sex and death.
Hmm.
No connection so far. Nobody else thought of this. No elephants thinking about sex and death. No monkeys thinking about sex and death. Hominids. Homo sapiens suddenly say, I think there's a relationship.
Well, along with the capacity to think in the future comes the awareness that if death comes for everyone, it shall also come for me. This comes as a direct result of abstract thinking, of being able to predict the future. One of the ways in which hominids became able to predict the future, for instance, is through menses that come with moon cycles, right? They come and go when the moon waxes or wanes. I never remember those words, Armand, but with the phases of the moon, you can predict a woman's menstruation, the onset of the menstruation, or you can kind of predict when ovulation is going to be. And then the other interesting aspect of this is that in a tribe, in a group of humans, females will go into this synchronistic menstruation pattern whereby their menses will all happen at the same time, and that facilitates impregnation. When you look at the dynamics of it, if all the females are fertile at the same time, that facilitates and makes it easier for them to get impregnated and for the rhythm to pick up in a certain way that makes, again, survival of the group easier and more successful. But along with the capacity to predict something comes the capacity to predict one's death. It makes sense, Armand. Except that somehow for women, death, well, I speculate when I say this, but I share this conviction with Dr. Schlein, death for women has always been easier to accept because there is something about the woman's capacity to give life that makes her less threatened at the thought of death, or makes her feel less uncomfortable at the idea of dying for some reason. In the male's psyche, death is more difficult to accept, more difficult to come to terms with. Also, a woman sees herself coming alive again through her child, because every time a woman gives birth, a part of her is reborn through that baby, with that baby. So she's already in contact with the fact that, yes, someday that baby is going to give birth to another baby, and then another baby, and another baby. And so there is already inherent in her psyche and in her life the concept of dying.
Yeah, and let's start off with the very act of sloughing off an egg that may not get fertilized.
Right. So every month
every month you bleed, and there's some consciousness of baby potential leaving, egg leaving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a death over and over again.
Well, I'm convinced, Armand, this is my own opinion, my own idea, that some of the grief that women experience
premenstrual
in
syndrome.
PMS is exactly the grief of knowing that this is another baby that didn't make it on some level.
Because if a woman is having her period,
it means she didn't get pregnant. Right, she didn't get impregnated, so that means this is one chance less. Of one less baby that I'm going to have.
Therefore, the mood and therefore a lot of the things that go along with PMS make sense. You know, the feeling of possessiveness, the feeling of irritation and anger, the kind of rage that can
sometimes...
And grief.
Grief. I have found in working with women, I have found that when they experience PMS, grief is a big issue, is a big problem, also because grief is a kind of a taboo feeling. People don't like to admit that they're experiencing it, so it's difficult to talk about. But when you get into it and you open up that door, Armand, it's a flood often. It comes flooding out. Anyway, back
to... The interesting thing about it also, Roberta, is that it too, like menses, has to be hidden. You see, it too has to be the fact that this is taking place is not common parlance. You know, this is not the woman who will say to her husband, oh, I'm about to have my period, so I think I'm a little more worried about whether our kids are going to school or not. You know? No, most likely she's going to say, I'm very worried about Tommy and whether he's going to get into Harvard, even though he's only 2 years old. And this is the kind of concern that could become really obsessional, but behind it is a thing that is motivating this. This is a sense of loss, a sense of grief, a sense of death.
Well, every month when there is that bleeding, there is a sense that life is passing by and that things are going, things are coming, but things are leaving.
You know, we have to make a case for the fact that women will produce 2/3 of their lives and then live another 1/3 of their lives beyond their production phase, which no animal does.
Right.
All animals can get pregnant till they die.
Yep. So that's another part that
we're
going
to get to that
about,
a little later, because why do women therefore go to menopause and then go through menopause and still stick around for a full 1/3 of their lives after that?
Mm-hmm. And actually, that's a time when, if we left it alone, in my opinion, you know, we tend to interfere with that phase of life too much by correcting it with hormones. That's just my opinion. If we left it alone, that's a time when actually women tend to be very powerful. They tend to have, in more traditional cultures, for instance, or societies, that's the time when women truly make their voices heard. And that's the time when the woman, no longer preoccupied with being feminine, let's say, is able to assert herself and to go out there. You know, Armand, what I discovered through reading the work of Dr. Schlein, that the more testosterone you have, percentage-wise, compared to other hormones in your blood, the farther away from home you're likely to wander. Now, when you look at women, when they go into menopause, they have more testosterone.
Let's go back to that. Women have more testosterone, but the more testosterone...
All women have some testosterone, right?
And if a male has more testosterone, he is more likely to wander.
Yep.
It's like, it reminds me of another thing I read, which is going to be a diversion for a moment, in Sperm Wars by Robin Baker. He makes a point about testicle size.
He says
that men with larger testicles have therefore tend to produce more sperm and are more likely to stray from home than men with smaller testicles. So
there
in effect,
go.
If you want to know, if you want to know whether a guy is going to be faithful or not, you can check. You know what I mean? He should be card carrying.
Before I go out on a date with you, do you mind, can you pull down your pants, please? I need to check something.
This is what I need to know. Are you going to be faithful or not?
But it makes sense. Same theory. I mean, same observation.
So more testosterone, more likely to wander.
Because if you wander, you're going to challenge more, and you're going to try to dominate more. When you wander off, the farther you go, the bigger your territory is that you wander off onto, the more likely you are to meet new mates and new possibilities for reproducing and to spread your seed far and wide. Well, but that's true for females as well, that when they get into menopause, and in in relation to their other hormones, the estrogen and the progesterone, testosterone is much higher now, should be much higher, because you have less of the other two. So at that time is when a woman really goes out of the home and no longer is constricted by the demands of motherhood and can go out into the world and express herself in ways that were not so possible before, when she needed to be closer to the children. So she can be a force, a healing power in society at that age, which for most animals, that's death. I mean, after the reproductive years are over, that's it. The female becomes just an expensive organism, needless for the group, that we can just do away with. Not for humans. At that time, actually, females are needed very much by their society, by the tribe. So, but we'll talk more about that.
I was talking to one of my associates here, Linda Van Ness, who was on the radio with us the other day, Roberta, who was talking about peak experiences in women, particularly at this time of life, when the testosterone is more present, when they are ready to wander, how if you could bring them to their peak experiences and ride that peak experiences, they become so much more powerful and potent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the work that she does specifically with people, to empower them at that time of year,
at that time of life. Yeah, that's amazing, because this is what I'm studying also, that if we left it alone, Armand, this is a time when women have so much power. They have finally reached the time of their lives.
Well, why do you think we don't leave it alone?
Well, because we don't want women to
have
that much power.
Why do you think us medical association suddenly decides, well, wait a minute, we want you to stay female?
Yes,
right.
Exactly. That's
go
exactly
back,
what
take,
we
take
do.
Take these hormones and go back to being
because
female,
we
female,
be
and
able,
stop being challenging.
We want to be able to control you better and to keep controlling you. And if you take your estrogen, it's going to be a lot easier to control you than if you let your testosterone go up. So, and that's a whole other show that we're going
to
do.
So let's get back to
what
happens.
Let's get back to what happens
with the cave drawings.
Okay. So 40,000 years ago. Well, this is a topic that has so many aspects that are so fascinating that it's easy to get off on a tangent.
Let's let people know, if they want, they could review. The book is Robin Baker, Sperm Wars. It's available on Amazon and paperback.
And the other one is the book by Dr. Leonard Schlein, S-H-L-A-I-N, Sex, Time, and Power, How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution. Fascinating book.
Okay.
So let's go back to 40,000 years ago. So
and
here we are in the cave. Here we are, cave-dwelling hominids, Homo sapiens, and the women have known for a certain amount of time that there's a link between sex and death. But they're not so eager, for some reason, to share that with the guys. They kind of want to keep that control because it makes their lives easier. So women, there was a great span of time when, I think it would be the time that you would call when the goddess was alive, and then she was dethroned. But there was a time when women had a great deal of power, and for instance, women could take more than one husband. Women could own things. Women were really as powerful in the society
as
men are
today.
Wait,
now this is not before 40,000 years ago. That was much later.
Well, but we're also talking about the time when women were the only recognizable parent, so they were the only ones giving life to the next generation.
Okay,
and that gave them, in that hominid culture, in that hominid society, however primitive it was, it gave them quite a bit of power.
40,000 years ago, Roberta, I am imagining people barely standing up. I mean, they're walking around.
Oh, they stood up already.
They're walking around on all twos. They're carrying bats. They don't have many tools yet. They're developing tools, right? And they are kind of going back.
Well, yes, you're right. Compared to our society of today, Armand, they are much more limited in their expression, in the way they handle their lives. But there is already a human structure to their life. There is already the foundation for human interactions. There is already the foundation for human love and behavior and bonding. So what I'm saying is that in that 100,000 years that we're talking about, where hominids, Homo sapiens, was developing into what it is today, women, females, had more control and power than they have today. And it's just an observation I'm making about that time. Then, yes, we also have a resurgence of the goddess later on, and we can get into that. But anyway, back to the cave.
So man looks. He says to himself, hey, I think death has something to do with things. Now, let me look down. And he suddenly looks down, and he sees this bunch of kids. Now, it is important to understand that no male animals have ever been connected to their offspring. This is very important. They know they have sex, but they don't know the offspring is theirs.
No, there's no mental connection. They may have some feelings towards the children of the tribe, but the males don't think of the children as having anything to do with them. They just see the children coming out of the women's bellies, and they think this is what women do, and they don't know that they have anything to do with it. They just think that being a parent is a woman's lot, it's a woman's job, it's a woman's gift. And they don't know that they have anything to do with it. They cannot make the connection mentally between having mated with that particular woman and that woman having a child. So all of a sudden, here is the primitive guy who is now preoccupied with death because he has enough smarts to realize that someday this is going to happen to him. He's going to die. But at the same moment as he's preoccupied with death and he thinks, my God, I'm going to disappear, nothing's going to be left of me, what he sees is a little toddler running around who shares some of the physical qualities and traits as well as the behaviors and the ways of expressing himself as that he has. And all of a sudden, he makes a connection. Holy moly, this child looks like me. Now, that's a big revelation if you think that had never happened before. And today, animals have no clue that they father an offspring.
No, very likely a male will easily kill his son.
Yes.
In a battle for a female.
They could.
Right?
They
so
could
we're going to talk about what would happen. What happens when a male suddenly accepts that this child is his, and at the same time he's looking and thinking about things like death. Hey, I may die too. Hey, this baby is somehow born as a result of me. Hey, maybe I won't die. If this baby carries on for me.
Right. If my essence participates in the creation of this human being, then this human being is capable of carrying into the future that very essence that was necessary to make it, to make him physically and in every other way. Therefore, the concept of fatherhood and the investment, emotional, mental, and physical, that men make from that moment on is an attempt to offset death, is an attempt to acquire immortality. It's a victory over death, actually.
This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind and Roberta Atti. It's a funny thing, friends. It's a funny thing that what we're talking about is that man's real motivation for acknowledging and seeing his own fatherhood, right, as he is a father, is because he's going to stay alive this way. That's the only advantage to accepting parenting.
Well, think of it also in terms of, a man's life back then was probably rather short. And during a man's life, what were the important things? Making a spear that throws better than other spears. Making a weapon that works better in the hunt. Having learned from my mistakes certain things that make my life better and my people's lives better. So all of this will die with me. Once I'm aware of that I'm going to die, all of my knowledge that I've acquired through making mistakes and suffering because of them will die with me. But if I have a son that I can give this knowledge to, and that can even inherit my spear, that can inherit my axe, then all of this suffering, all of this learning will not have been for nothing, because it can be thrown into the future through my son. Now, this is a great revelation, and it immediately causes a man to want to become involved with the raising of that child, to want to invest not just his sperm, but also his life energy in raising this kid, teaching the kid, and getting involved with all aspects of raising the child, not just out of concern for the woman he may have feelings for, you know, his mate, the mother of the child, but out of the fact that there's a direct connection, a parenting connection between him and the child, excluding the woman. There's direct connection. The woman could not have had this child without me. Therefore, part of this child is mine. And I can live beyond my death through this child.
You know any people like that? Any fathers like that living through their children?
Yes.
You know? And now let's think about this just a step further. Now, there is two kinds of jealousies, right? There's a jealousy. Jealousy starts to develop. A man's jealousy is different than a woman's jealousy. A woman's jealousy is, I'm afraid that if my man goes off and he has sex with another woman, that he's going to want to choose her and leave me. That's the tribal fear. But I'm afraid that if he goes off and has sex with another female, he's going to choose them to have sex with, her to have sex with, and he'll leave me behind here with my mishpucha, not knowing what to do. But that's male jealousy, see? Female jealousy. Male jealousy is very different. Male jealousy is, I am afraid that if she has sex with another animal, that she will carry this other animal's sperm, she will give birth to a baby that I will think is mine, I will be taking care of a baby that is not mine. I have known men who, when you talk to them about how unreasonable their rage is when they find out that the mate that they had is having sex with another woman, he says, if they've been touched by another man, I can't even think about it. If they've had sex with another man, I cannot think about it. If another man's thing was inside her, I can never touch her again. That's the way certain men feel. Now, what is that? What is he saying? He's saying, because the threat here is I may be taking care of the baby that's not mine. Now, think about this for selection. So the male's jealousy is I must control her from being with another man. Now, that's one thing. Well, meanwhile, the society has this rule. Men are always ready. If she walks down the street, any man coming along might be ready to jump on her. So how do we prevent other men from being with the lady whose child I want her to have my child, and I don't want any other men to be near her? How do we make it happen?
I think it even goes beyond that, Armand. If this woman is going to have someone else's child, then my genes, my immortality goes out the window. I'm not going to survive my death. See, when we're talking about jealousy in a male, having a child through a woman is the only way in which a man can feel that his life is prolonged into immortality through the child he's having with this woman. But if you take that out of the picture, now death comes back bigger than before. Comes back. And so that's what, at the foundation of it, it's really, when you're talking about jealousy, it's fear of death. It's revulsion about death. But let's go back to what you were saying about the need to control reproduction.
Yeah, we will. And that's where we're going to come back next, to talking about the need to control reproduction, my friends. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Ati. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Be sure to stay tuned. And we're back with you. Let's talk about paternity.
Okay, so here we have a male thinking about death, his own death, and getting all distressed about it. And then he looks down, he sees a toddler, he sees the toddler's mother next to the toddler, and he remembers the sweet encounters he has had with her. And he looks at the toddler and he thinks, my God, he has the same hair as I do. He has the same dimples. He has the same color of eyes. Could it be? And he comes to the conclusion that this could be my son. So now the question is, well, this kid looks like me, but let's say that, you know, it's not always so easy to tell who looks like who. So how do I make sure that the child I'm supporting and contributing in the raising of is my own? We're going to establish some laws that are going to control the sexuality of everyone, male or female. Now, how are we going to do it? The males are going to make a pledge that they're not going to force themselves upon a woman, and that they will lay only with one female. Because if I only lay with one female and she only gets my seed, then the offspring of that female is going to be my own. But then how do I control her behavior? How do I make sure that she doesn't sleep
out? Do you think the men make that deal with each other, or the men make the deal saying, you will not sleep with mine?
I think that the men made a deal. I don't know. I'm going actually by Dr. Schlein's speculation, which I happen to find fascinating along his lines, and the men decided, okay, the only way that we have to control this to make sure my child is really mine is if I only lay with one woman and if she only lays with me.
Therefore, monogamy is born.
Monogamy is born.
The concept of monogamy.
Out of the need to offset death.
Robin Baker, on the other hand, says that according to his research, what really happened was you said, I will only sleep with one woman unless I go away.
There's a clause there that Dr. Schlein did not consider.
There's a clause. He says, if I go away and I get at a big enough distance, I could sleep with other people and have other babies. Mm-hmm. And I may not even know it, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to rear the ones that are with the woman with whom I have the sworn monogamy. Those are the ones, when I say rear, that means I'm going to go out and bring home the iron.
Yes.
Right? Not the 5-iron, not the 4-iron.
Right.
We're not talking about golf. We're talking about bring home the meat.
The meat. Bring home the hunt, yes.
Why do the women need meat so much?
Because they lose so much iron through their reproductive years, through menstruation, through childbirth. A woman is liable to lose gallons of
the placenta.
Blood. The placenta, which is a sponge soaked in blood. I mean, anybody who has witnessed a childbirth knows how bloody this event is. I mean, it looks, one leaves the event thinking, how is the woman going to survive this?
Even lactation, which is nobody knows, lactation. Mother's milk is
blood turned sweet.
Blood turns sweet, so that's what the baby is drinking.
That's right. So all of these fluids that go into making the baby's body and then supporting it, feeding it once it's outside of the womb, all of these fluids require iron. And
you know, Roberta,
my friend,
since you said it, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Mother's milk is blood turned sweet.
Yes.
Ever since you've said that, it's been sitting in my head. You mean everybody's drinking their mother's blood?
Absolutely. It's a form of vampirism.
Really?
Yeah, it is.
How does it work? How does blood turn into milk?
Well, through the alchemy of the woman's body. The woman's body is able to take her own blood and transform it into milk.
You mean there are not many differences between blood and milk?
Not that many, except that the milk, of course, is higher in carbohydrates, which are required for human nutrition. So milk is perfectly designed to meet the needs of a growing body of a baby. Now, blood may be too concentrated, for instance. So milk has more water in it, and I think blood would have been too concentrated for the little baby's stomach to digest. The little baby's stomach is able to digest milk because it contains the elements of blood, the minerals and the trace minerals and the vitamins and the enzymes and all these things, but it's also very diluted. Plus, a woman's milk also contains all of her antibodies, you see. So everything that the immune system of the woman has learned through being alive on Earth in that territory where she is needs to be communicated to the baby, because the baby supposedly is going to live in the same spot where she is. So if I'm born in Africa, for instance, hopefully my mother has lived in Africa for long enough that her immune system has become acquainted with what's local, with the local fauna and flora. But if I am born in Australia, hopefully my mother has lived in Australia for long enough that her immune system knows what's around and communicates that chemically to me through the milk, so that my immune system, which is incompetent at birth — a human immune system is highly incompetent in birth, as incompetent as a nervous system. I mean, the nervous system of humans at birth is so incompetent that we're the most dependent beings on Earth, and this leads us into our next section of this presentation. We are so incompetent, dependent, and unable to survive on our own at birth that the woman, the mother, has to make a major investment of her life blood in order to make sure that we survive. And there are advantages or disadvantages to this. The advantage is that since most of our development happens outside the womb, Armand, we are the most pliable mentally of all species, because our nervous system is born so empty, so undeveloped, so really unskilled. We can learn the most. It's the most flexible, because most other animals are born with a nervous system that's already quite developed, or developed enough that the challenges presented to that animal are going to be just about — that baby's going to be able to just about meet the challenges almost immediately after birth.
A baby turtle gets out of an egg and he's ready to live if nothing catches him.
He's independent, yes, right? Just about. But that means there's very little space for learning anything new, whereas in humans we have an enormous capacity for learning, precisely because we're born so dependent and so unable to take care of ourselves.
So dependent for so many years.
Right, and this leads
15 years of dependency.
At least.
You know, so you've got to figure, if you've got a kid who's not in jail and not in drugs and not dead, by the time he's 15, you've succeeded as a parent.
Absolutely. I think so, Armand. At 15, if your kid is basically okay, you've done very well. Yes.
Basically okay means basically okay. Basically, if the kid has survived, it's amazing.
Yep.
That's a mother's role.
Yes.
Get the kid that far. She has given up all of her energy. She's given out so much stuff. She has gone out. I'm not even talking about working women. I'm talking about even women at home.
Well, she gives her physical substance to this kid. I mean, every child a woman has eats her, literally eats her alive, because you give your blood, you give your milk, and then you continue to give so much of your physical self in supporting your children that, you know, everyone knows how difficult it is to be a young mother with small children who are literally eating you alive, and you're doing everything you can to meet their needs, and yet there's constant demands put on you that are very difficult to meet, especially in a culture like ours where the father is now absent, right? The father picks up in the morning, he leaves, he's gone for most of the day, and you're left with...
So what's dad going to do? Dad's going to bring home the bacon.
The bacon, which is his job. I mean, we need the meat, so he goes out. And Armand, we're going to have to do a program about this issue alone, because I've had so many comments and so many questions and so many reactions to the fact that I'm talking about this as if humans were meant to be carnivorous. And of course, there are tremendous objections to that, especially on the part of the WBI audience. So I think we need to address that in one program that we're going to set aside just to talk about mm-hmm. that issue. But back to the situation of
man's got to go out to bring back whatever it is that keeps the mother going,
the tofu,
and keeps the baby going.
Okay, let's say the tofu
or the kale
or the kale,
whatever it is.
And so now we're coming to the fact that women stop menstruating and stop being fertile about 2/3 into their lives. And this is a question mark. Why would it be?
Why menopause?
Why menopause? Yes, it seems like such a redundancy to have females running around that have no use, no reproductive use, and are no longer able to have children. So why should they be kept alive? And yet this is when women, as we said before, sometimes are at the height of their power. Well, this is precisely because it takes so long to raise a human baby, and it takes so much energy that without a grandmother, it becomes very difficult for a mother alone to do the job. So grandmothers are, in Dr. Schlein's research and in his opinion, grandmothers are one of the main reasons why the human species has been so successful. Because think about it, up until the age at which you have, then you go into menopause, you can reproduce, which means that if you get pregnant, let's say at 40, you can see your child through the crucial years before you start thinking about dying, right? So you can, you have it set up in such a way that you have enough time left between the time you end your reproductive years and the time your last offspring is independent. You have the time to take care of this kid, and you don't die right away. You see what I'm saying? So that's one reason. And the other reason is that when you get to that age where you are, let's say, between 40 and 60, between 45 and 65, between 50 and 70, when you're no longer reproductively viable, what you can do is help raise the children of your daughter. And this, of course, makes it a lot easier for your daughter, but also makes it, enhances the survival of the tribe, of the community, of the group, because grandmothers are known for their knowledge and wisdom and skills. Did you know, Armand, that a grandmother, according to Dr. Schlein's research, a grandmother in traditional communities and societies is better at bringing home calories and food and herbal medicine that the daughter needs and the baby need better than the daughter's mate? So the grandmother is actually at times better provider for her daughter than the daughter's husband or mate, because the woman, the older woman, has the knowledge of having survived long enough that she knows the plants that are medicinal. She knows how babies get sick and how to treat them when they get sick. She's been through all these things. So when her daughter is first encountering the first baby's, you know, fever, the daughter may panic because she has no experience of it. She doesn't know what to do. But here's the grandmother who knows because she's been through it. And she calms down the daughter and she brings home the herbs. Gatherers in hunter-gatherer societies, the hunters are important because they bring home the bacon. But the gatherers bring home 80% of the food needed to support that family. So while the men bring home a necessary piece of that diet, represented by the meat and the iron, the gatherers bring home the volume, the quantity that is required to feed that growing family.
And what's Grandpa doing? He's
guarding the gate, and also he is teaching the younger kids, the younger boys. Grandpa is making sure that the boys learn what it means to be a man, and that the boys grow up with the knowledge of how to treat women, because also one of the best ways to keep a woman, we didn't get into that, one of the best ways, you have two ways of keeping a woman faithful so that her children will be indeed your offspring. One is to threaten her with horrible punishment if she strays, but there's another way, and that is to keep her so happy and satisfied that she will not have the need to stray.
Whoever heard of such a thing?
apparently that was the most popular, the most popular way of doing things back then. I'm not sure why it has, you know, kind of sizzled out a bit, but it seems to be that if you keep a woman happy, and if you make her feel loved and supported, and if you make her feel secure that things aren't, that, you know, the meat is going to keep coming home and that she is going to be helped with the job of
raising
the kids.
And he's not going to run off with another family.
And he's not going to run off with another family, exactly. She's not likely to seek sex elsewhere. As long as she's secure in her ability to feed her babies, to take care of them, and therefore to take care of herself, because she knows her babies need her, she's not interested in going off seeking some strange male who may turn out to be a disappointment and may turn out to, you know, be
even harmful.
Even harmful, exactly. And most of all, harmful to her babies. You know, he may represent a threat, because, I mean, even in primitive, in more traditional, in more primitive in societies, it is known that adult males will kill infants of other males.
Right, like the lions do.
Exactly.
New lion comes into a pride, kicks off the old lion, goes in
kills all the babies.
Eats the babies.
So it is in the woman's interest to be faithful, because that's in the best interest of her offspring. But if the male is not providing for her or is not treating her with kindness, then she is likely to seek what she needs elsewhere.
This is Armand with Roberta Atti. There'll be more of this coming.